Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. What I want to talk about today is finding common ground. There seems to be a lot of fear and anxiety about what's going on in the world right now. A lot of concern about what's happening politically, economically. The reality of climate change is upon us. We're seeing drought, forest fires, any number of things. And I am hearing expressions of people feeling overwhelmed and kind of helpless, you know. What's to do? What can we do? And of course, on the home front, there always are those things cooking, right? At a very personal level. Things happening at work, in your families, in your relationships. So many people wonder, you know, well, there's my spiritual practice and there's the rest of life. So, you know, what's the connection? And actually, all of these conditions that I just described are themselves the very rich field of our practice. Even though we might not necessarily have chosen them, these particular ones, but here they are. And there is nothing that the Buddhist teaching does not touch. No matter how difficult things get personally or globally, these conditions themselves are the very means by which we know the Buddha's truth. So, actually, the phrase itself, finding common ground, is cheering because it suggests there actually is common ground. You know, but the thing of it is, we actually act on common ground all the time without necessarily recognizing it. We just had this wonderful transfer of merit ceremony, which of course is based on the understanding of common ground, the intimate connection that we all have with one another, and the way that we can influence each other, and the way that our training can help others. You know, in this lovely part of the dedication of merit, if people hear and see how hands and hearts can find in giving unity, may their minds awake to great compassion, wisdom, and to joy. May kindness find reward, may all who sorrow leave their grief and pain. May this boundless light break the darkness of their endless night. Because our hearts are one, this world of pain turns into paradise. May all become compassionate and wise. Now that's a promise, isn't it? This is what can happen. When hands and hearts can find in giving unity. You know, we see this happen all the time, but we don't necessarily recognize the basis of it. There's this lovely dialogue in the book The Art of Happiness, which consists of many, many travels of the Dalai Lama and Howard Cutler, who is a psychologist who attends many of these lectures and is in the wonderful position of being able to talk with him about it. The thing I find so interesting about the dialogues in this book is because Howard Cutler is an American, and he, of course, it represents how we think about things. And when he talks about things, it's possible to see assumptions. Oh, right. You know, in this culture, he speaks about many, many attitudes of mind that as Westerners we bring to Buddhist teaching, and he has a hard time with a lot of the Dalai Lama's teaching. He's trying to get the hang of it, but he talks a lot about how much resistance he has to the idea of interdependence. He says, I have always valued and enjoyed my friends and family, and I've considered myself to be an independent person, self-reliant. Prided myself on this quality. Secretly, I have tended to regard overly dependent people with a kind of contempt, a sign of weakness. He said, then that afternoon, as I listened to the Dalai Lama, something happened. As our, in quotes, dependence on others was not my favorite topic, my mind started to wander again, and I found myself absent-mindedly removing a loose thread from my shirt sleeve. Tuning in for a moment, I listened as he mentioned the many people who are involved in making all our material possessions. As he said this, I began to think about how many people were involved in making this shirt. I started by imagining the farmer who grew the cotton, next the salesperson who sold the farmer the tractor to plow the field. Then, for that matter, the hundreds or even thousands of people involved in manufacturing that tractor, including the people who mined the ore to make the metal for each part of the tractor, and all the designers of the tractor. Then, of course, the people who processed the cotton, the people who wove the cloth, the cargo workers and truck drivers who delivered the shirt to the store, and the salesperson who sold the shirt to me. It occurred to me that virtually every aspect of my life came about as the result of others' efforts. My precious self-reliance was a complete illusion, a fantasy. As this realization dawned on me, I was overcome with a profound sense of the interconnectedness and interdependence of all beings. He said, I felt a softening, something. I don't know. It made me want to cry. So, given this profound interdependence that we have, how can we learn to find common ground with those who his views are different from us, and work together to find solutions on a private level, on a community level, on a global level. You can try it at your breakfast table with your family. There are also... As soon as we begin to do this, you know, we get a really much more spacious vista. We already really know how to do this. You all know how to do it. You do it all the time, maybe without recognizing it, until you come to some place where you stub your toe and think, oh, wait a minute. Maybe not here, but, you know, in some other places it works. But It actually it is a basic Buddhist teaching that we can all find common ground. And actually we know that we can. But we may not know that we know. Sometimes we think, gee, I really need to get some more information before I do this. You know, maybe I should get it, download another CD or read another Dharma talk before I plunge into this, because it sounds like it's going to be kind of difficult, and, you know, probably there's more I need to learn about it. But as you've heard me quote before, Master Hua, who was the late abbot of the city of 10,000 Buddhas and was himself an incredible master and scholar and translator. He translated the Avatamsaka scripture and wrote a commentary on it. It is a great treasure of Mahayana literature. And somebody was talking to him about being worried about, you know, not being able to understand the scriptures, being worried about everything that they didn't know. And he said, don't worry about what you don't know. He said, worry about what you know and are not practicing. So, because actually we don't know what we know until we put it into practice. Out of the practice comes the teaching. So, I asked some of you a few weeks ago about this topic of common ground. What comes up when you think about common ground? And you had some very interesting things to say. Somebody said right off, well, that's the whole practice, isn't it? Common ground, Buddha nature, we all have it. And our practice is really finding that in a very intimate way for ourselves and seeing it reflected all around us in everyone and everything. So so that's a pretty big order right there. Some people said, listen, start with listening. When you are talking with someone, listen. That sounds really easy. And then somebody else said, listen with compassion and listen with patience. This can be really hard to do because of our mind's tendency to want to see things in black and white. There was a really interesting and helpful article in this last journal. Let's see if I can negotiate this. Called Form and Pure. Written by Fer de Deken from the Netherlands. Now, I am really sorry, I don't know how to pronounce the name, and I'm frankly not sure if this is a man or a woman. So out of the best I can do to be respectful, I'm going to refer to the person who wrote the article as the author. And what the author starts out with is saying there's a scripture in which the whole of Buddhism is reflected. It's the scripture of great wisdom. And then a few lines are quoted. O Shariputra, form is only pure. Pure is all form. There is then nothing more than this. For what is form is pure, and what is pure is form. And the author says, this puzzled me deeply. And reflecting on it while on a hiking holiday, a couple of hundred kilometers, some of this clarified for me. And below is my account. And they give a brief description of seeing. Now, as part of this, there is an image that's used in this article. And some of you may recognize this kind of thing, right? This is something that I can remember studying in psychology classes. It has to do with helping us see something about how we perceive things. Because if you look at the figure, which is a black vase in the middle, that's fine. But there are two outlines of profiles of faces surrounding that picture. And the thing is, as soon as you look at one, the other one disappears. So this is the figure that the author is writing about, and I feel like the way it is talked about is just very helpful. So pure seeing is simply awareness of loose parts, but the ego, and I'm taking some liberty here, but I think probably we could also call it the self, those of us who forgot what the ego, the meaning of the ego, we sure know what the self means. So the self is continually trying to make a whole of these loose parts. In the drawing below, you can see two forms, a vase or two faces looking at each other. Because this image is not stable, you will notice that it switches all the time from one picture to the other. It's a restless image. I think that's a very helpful thing to keep in mind. There's a feeling of restlessness about it, and that is because the self cannot see both forms at the same time. This is only possible in the intuitive, quotes, being mode, which, again, loose translation, I would call it the mind of meditation. The mind of meditation can hold both of those images. The self is constantly looking for one fixed form or a gestalt with which it feels comfortable. It clings to a form because that prevents restlessness, as the self is dependent on form. This clinging to a view, the attachment to form, is a common prop in our lives. So the truth is right in front of us, but we're looking with one eye and then this eye. And actually, these two images do not stand against one another, which is, of course, the one of the most basic teachings of Buddhism is everything is included. There is nothing that is outside. So I felt like this is a very helpful description, at least it sure rang a bell with me, in what my mind starts to do in trying to set up the opposites, you know, without even realizing it's just the good guys and the bad guys. And this kind of thing that we can so easily get into, because it's much more relaxing than trying to hold, you know, until you get the hang of it. It's kind of like holding a hot potato. You keep kind of batting it forth from one side to the other. But we know somehow that that's not really true. You know, we know what we have to go through to see something as either all black or all white. And something in us something in us knows intuitively that, how do I want to say this? We're being untrue to ourselves in some kind of way. Well, you know, it is really, it's a breakage of the precepts. We're selling ourselves the wine of delusion. We are not being truthful with ourselves or others as well. But there is that sense of unease about it. And so it's just helpful to know when we're in that place and that there actually is a third position, as Reverend Master Jiu used to call it, a place beyond the opposites where you can rest at ease in the mind of meditation. So there is a very interesting and I think helpful paradigm for some people who overcame this black and white situation they were having. In this little excerpt that comes from Mind of Clover by Aiken Roshi, he is describing this conversation. I think I may have shared this with a few of you previously, but it kept coming up when I was thinking about this talk as a way of, here's an example of how it can be done. So the ideal of the society of friends is, in quotes, speaking. Hang on a second. Let me rephrase this. Speaking truth to power, in quotes, is the ideal of the society of friends, which is nonviolent and inclusive. Recently, leaders of a peace organization arranged to meet with a senior military officer who had broad authority. I don't know why he agreed to meet with them. And I didn't hear the outcome of the meeting. But I was told about the discussions in the organization before the meeting took place. The delegation had to decide what to say. After role-playing several scenarios, the members gave up. And they decided just to open the conversation with the question, "How is it going?" In other words, with your truly awesome power, with nuclear war, a possible outcome of something that you might decide to do in an emergency, how are you bearing up? When we speak from the same side of the counter in this way, then we are human beings together, and the we-they dichotomy falls away, and peace has a chance. I love that image of speaking from the same side of the counter. You know, we can ask ourselves in various situations, what can I do here, to wind up on the same side of the counter? Actually, this is something, one of those kitchen table examples. It wasn't a matter of nuclear weapons and peace and war. But of course, those things always can develop out of very common encounters. But there's something about this, again, written by the same person who wrote the piece about the images. This lovely little vignette about what happened with their neighbor. During the 3 weeks that we were on the hiking vacation, our neighbors looked after our cat. When we unexpectedly came back earlier, we saw a huge room-filling plant standing in the sun parlor. The neighbors had bought it and found it was much too big for their room, so for the time being, they parked it in our parlor. When they noticed our return, they felt ashamed because, of course, good form requires that one asks permission before using someone else's private territory. But they thought that they would be back later on and they'd have a chance to take the plant out. But meanwhile, so that didn't happen, as they put it, now the shame. Compassion lets go of the idea of good form and sees what is there. The separate parts, that is the plant and shame, and my own irritation, and finds from the emptiness or pure of the separate parts, enabling a new form. So I referred to the plant as a guest who behaved very well. made no noise, nicely emptied his water bowl, and provided fresh air. He may come again and stay. So by offering a new form, that is the plant as a guest instead of improper use of my room, the awkwardness of the situation was resolved and everyone felt fine. This is a much more powerful way than using a soother like, oh, it's all right, it doesn't matter, because then the existing way of viewing things is just being denied, although it endures. While a new way of looking pushes the old way to the background, that is, self cannot live in two forms at the same time, see the vase, has advantages, as was the case with my neighbors who were relieved and in the newly offered form, the plant as a guest, could join in the banter. So from form, one can experience emptiness through the help of compassion. That closes the circle of form and pure. You know, I appreciate this story especially because I have a huge plant that lives with me. Someone gave it to me, and I've taken care of it for many years, and it just gets bigger and bigger, and I feel like it's a roommate. And so one summer I was thinking, gosh, you know, it's time to find another home for this plant. But it was a very smoky summer. And all of a sudden, I realized that the plant was really helping me. It was helping me breathe. And I had an entirely different view of this plant, who we've been living happily together ever since. But this is such a skillful way that this person has described how to transform a situation. So they both wind up really on the same side of the table and can just be at ease with one another. So, there are really any number of times and places where people are finding common ground, and I think it's very reassuring to keep these in mind. People are working together all over the globe, and many, many, many things can be a source of unity. Nelson Mandela used rugby to unify the white and black population when he came into office in South Africa. And from the description of it, it was an incredible example of wisdom and compassion and kindness. And he found a way, actually, of working with people so that they did all wind up on the same side of the table. And I think it's a sort of a blueprint of how it can be done. Certainly, people join together to offer medical services. Doctors Without Borders go all over the world to offer help. Doctors from all countries go to offer help to people of all countries in all situations. And many, many times political borders are lifted in order for them to have access to people who need help. Certainly when we have natural disasters anywhere in the world, and especially now that we can actually see what's happening through television, there are outpourings of aid of all kinds. And you know, the thing of it is, nobody wonders what's the common denominator here. We all know. We all know what we need. Everybody needs food and shelter and water and medicine. And the concern for the children is always one of the primary parts of this. So, you know, when push comes to shove, we know just what to do. And we are really drawing, as somebody wrote, from that deep well of humanity that we all share and that surpasses any kind of religious or political beliefs. So, again, it's a question really of going back to what we already know and really to take refuge in that and then see how to practice it. You know, these are some dramatic samples here. We just heard about the when our hermitage in Quartz Valley was under... I'm sorry, I'm losing track of a thought here. Fire advisory, you know, what's the word I'm thinking of? Thank you, the evacuation advisory, yeah. We heard from Reverend Esther Dyson and Reverend Enya the incredible story of how all the firemen and all of the people out in this area work together really ceaselessly. And in their efforts that they were able to ensure the safety of all the people who were living in the surrounding areas and did their best to protect the buildings as well, and of course ultimately were successful in containing a great deal of the fire out there. And people came, these firefighters came from all over the country, and some of them had more training than others. The National Guard was there. There were inmates from correctional facilities that were helping out. So everyone had the common ground of wanting to put the fire out and to make sure that everybody was safe. And there were private interests, there were government interests, there was a lot on the table. And it was resolved sufficiently for them to be able to make this incredible effort. And you know, we see this happening all the time. And we ourselves can be the vehicle for this kind of cooperation. I mean, heck, you can do it in your own family. We try to do it. We work on this here in the monastery. We are living in a very small community, I mean, very closely together. We're all very, very different, as you all know. And as we like to say sometimes, well, we might not have all chosen to live so closely together, you know, be friends in the way that you think about choosing friends. And there is this bond of very, very deep commitment to our practice and to it's a religious aspiration that goes way beyond any kind of personal things which we might get into periodically with one another and are just, you know, really just on the surface, but have no real life because of that common ground. We're also part of a group called California Interfaith Power and Light, which is a California-based group and also has a national membership. And this is a group of different religions that are coming together. And as they call it, it is a religious response to climate change and all of the ramifications of it. Supporting legislation, helping churches find alternatives in terms of power and water and all kinds of resources, helping congregation members to look at their homes and see what can be done on an individual level. And it's very, very interesting how, again, they put out a video a while back, which we showed here, probably a number of you saw it. But it was incredibly impressive to see people of different faiths and practices working together. And, you know, this doesn't mean there aren't differences. Of course there are. But it is a way and not pretending the differences aren't there, but it is possible to work with all of that. And so again, on a very, very small level, but something that I just deeply appreciated was something that was written. Again, this was this is Victor Chan, who traveled with the Dalai Lama and writes wonderful stories about the Dalai Lama, about his teachings, and about how he responds to people and people respond to him. And I'm sorry, that's not Victor Chan, it's Pico Iyer in the book The Open Road. He had attended an enormous meeting that where the Dalai Lama spoke and Desmond Tutu, and people of all walks of life were there, of every possible political and religious representation there. And there was a young man who was sitting with Pico during this meeting, and he told him afterwards, he said, he had written an article about this meeting and the talk, and he said, you know, it really made a difference. As soon as I got home, I went around and introduced myself to all my neighbors. It's not, I know, like changing the world, but it's a first step, I think. I've never done that before. So I'd like to end on that note. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha.